Speaking of Faith is supported by the Pew Charitable Trusts, investing in ideas, returning results. PewTrusts.com. Additional support is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith, conversation about belief, meaning, issues, and ideas. Today, the power of fundamentalism. Since September 11, 2001, religious fundamentalism has appeared as one of the greatest threats confronting the modern world. What is fundamentalism? It has a different history and expression in every religion. The dictionary defines it as a movement or attitude stressing strict adherence to a set of basic principles. But that does not begin to describe the power of this way of seeing the world, nor its potential to motivate and to destroy.
United 93, Cleveland.
That aircraft, you can't get a hold of. Has he turned to the east now?
He's just turned to the east also.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, three airplanes were hijacked. Here are excerpts from Air Traffic Control Exchange in Cleveland, monitoring United Airlines Flight 93, which crashed in rural Pennsylvania.
Yeah, we do have a smoke puff now at about, probably 2 o'clock. It appears to be just a dark cloud, like a puff of black smoke.
Today on Speaking of Faith, we'll explore the power of fundamentalism. We'll hear why some people became fundamentalist, what drew them out of it, and what we might learn from the fundamentalist impulse at this time. We'll speak with three men. They are Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, a lawyer, a seminary president, and a journalist. Each of them is deeply religious. And when these men now criticize fundamentalism, they are not describing someone else. They're speaking about themselves, their families of origin, their childhood friends.
It's a form of intoxication, and I grew out of it. But in the case of these kids, and they are kids, most of them never live long enough to outgrow it. Their lives are tragically short and tragically delusional.
When Khaled Abu El Fadl refers to these kids, he is also speaking of his own early years, a life he narrowly escaped. Today, he is a leading international authority in Islamic law and human rights, with degrees from Yale and Princeton. But he grew up in a middle-class family in Kuwait and Egypt, and he was a Muslim fundamentalist by the time he reached seventh grade. Now a professor at UCLA and Yale, Khaled Abu El Fadl compares the kinds of young people who join Muslim fundamentalist groups across the world with the kinds of young people who join gangs in cities across this country.
The main difference is that in the Islamic context, you've got to add a civilizational component. Normally, you know, a kid coming from a certain area of LA who decides to join a gang, he's not thinking about changing the world. Even a Christian fundamentalist in the United States who joins a Christian group is not thinking in those terms. But those kids, they grow up with numerous mythologies about the greatness of the past. And they look at their present, and their present is remarkably miserable at many different fronts.
Tell me how that was real and concrete for you.
As an Egyptian, it becomes very concrete when you think everywhere you turn, the identity to which you belong is confronted with military defeats. If you travel, you carry an Egyptian passport and you try to travel around the world, you've become thrown into a category of the inferior just by virtue of the fact that you belong to an Arab identity. And I remember, you know, going through a stage where I tried the sort of cool route of being westernized. That, for me, didn't work. And what did work was that exaltation, intoxication, remarkable high of finding a group of people that tell you, you know what, you're better than the Americans, you're better than the British, you're better than the Arabs, you're better than the Turks, you're better than anyone because you're Muslim and all you have to do is just simply accept our version of orthodoxy. And I remember as a teenager, suddenly I would walk around with my head high. I belong to something very powerful. And I could see the world as black and white, evil and good. And I was on the side, in fact, not on just on the side of good. Anyone who wants to achieve goodness has to come through me.
Hmm.
You know, they have to get my approval.
Right. That's the ultimate power.
So
right.
That was the high. That's the intoxication. Fortunately, I grew out of it. Unfortunately, many of these kids never get that chance.
I'm fighting for my Lord. I'm chopping coppers up like Hollywood is double-bladed sword. I lost my shield. Either I'm gonna live to see us win or I'ma die on the battlefield. Inshallah, get slaughtered and be a martyr in jihad. Fighting for my God. I lost upon the word of Allah. A long white boy is a war holler. Yo, it's time for jihad.
A section of the song Jihad by the Muslim rappers, Soldiers of Allah. Khaled Abou El Fadl is quick to note that there are versions of Islamic fundamentalism which are not violent. They may condemn the beliefs of others, but they leave judgment up to God. He uses the word supremacist or Puritan to describe the militant Saudi Arabian Wahhabi brand of Islam to which he once adhered and which we now associate with Al-Qaeda. Egyptian-born, Khaled Abou El Fadl is frequently called upon to analyze the theology of Islamic terrorism. And he cautions that social and political developments since the 1980s have left many young people in the Islamic world vulnerable to Wahhabi influence, whether they and their families are extremist or not.
In this theology, truth is unequivocally identifiable.
It is identifiable.
It is identifiable. Not only is there a truth, but this truth is attainable on this earth. Furthermore, the perfection of God is attainable on this earth. Third is that discussion, discourse, philosophy, history, all of that is either an aberration or sophistry. And I learned very early on during this phase that philosophy is the science of the devil. The devil invented philosophy in order to lead people astray. Intellectuals exist basically to confuse people. History, other than the time period of the prophet and his companions, which is highly idealized, the rest of history is basically an aberration.
And so this identifiable truth is located then in a literal reading of the Quran?
Well, that's what you're taught. I mean, that's what you are taught. And of course, you know, most of these kids, the honest truth is they're not very educated, or even if they are, their education is mostly in the sciences. When I started getting some education, everything that I was taught appeared to have been just a complete, remarkable fantasy and lie.
Hmm.
I mean, one of the things I can tell you as a matter of testimony is that the majority of kids who shared this view at that time had never read the Quran for themselves. And I remember that one of the teachers used to say that it's a sin to read the Quran directly because the devil will play with your intellect. You have to read it through your teacher, i.e. him.
You know, that really helps me, because in the bit that I know of the Quran and have read of the Quran, it strikes me that this is also true of the Christian Bible. You can't really take every line literally, because there's a lot of mm-hmm. contradictory teaching in there, or there's a lot of nuance that has to condition your understanding of the text if you really are taking it seriously.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that, you know, started giving me very serious doubts is that there is this sort of effect of eradication and destruction of your intellectual capacities. My father would tell me back then, have you noticed that since you've gone on this thing that even your vocabulary has deteriorated? So I can't open my mouth without throwing out some type of cliche that everyone in the mosque who attended these classes would be repeating.
In the West, when we look at the root sources of terrorism, we tend to think first of poverty. And I have no idea from the life you're describing what the economic situation was of you or the people around you. But I'm not sensing that you feel that that was as much a factor as the life of the mind and how that was oppressed.
I absolutely would agree with that. I mean, I think poverty does play some role. But it is not, in my own, at least in my experience and my own my view, it was not the main thing. The main thing was the social turmoil and the lack of an intellectual life. Every day you read the newspapers, and the new government sponsored newspapers, and they all said the same thing. And you know, you turn on the television, and there's nothing there. There are no honest, straightforward discussions about anything. You know, basically, it's either how wonderful the government is, or it's American movies that entice you with a life that you can never have. So in that atmosphere, the feeling that I remember very distinctly is that I would just feel suffocated. Right before I started, you know, attending the classes of these guys, day in and day out, I would wake up and go to bed, and always I would tell my mother and father, you know, what's the point? What's the point of this life?
At the age of 15, with his father's help, Khaled Abou El Fadl discovered a body of Islamic thought that opened his heart and mind. It is called Islamic jurisprudence, a term that sounds obscure in American ears. But simply put, it is a tradition with ancient roots which debates how the Quran might apply to every aspect of life. It is something like the Jewish Talmud. This tradition gave Khaled Abou El Fadl a life-changing alternative to fundamentalism, and he believes that it is the best hope for Islam today, a counterweight to the simplifications used by terrorists.
The more I delved into the Islamic jurisprudence and how humble it was, how these medieval jurists, how remarkably humble they talked, they would never say, God's law is. They would always say, in my view, God's law is, and God knows better.
Right. I mean, humility is not a term that we would associate with some of these more terrifying images, Islamic images we've had in the last months.
Far from it. To me, there was a little bit of a post-traumatic reaction as I watched bin Laden speak after 9/11.
In the videotape?
Yeah, on Al Jazeera channel, you know, I listened to it in Arabic, of course, and the smugness, the arrogance, the complete obliviousness to the other, and the suffering of the other, and the pain of the other. At one point, I had a physical reaction where I started feeling my body hurting, because at the time that I had informed these guys that I was no longer going to attend their classes. I'm going to attend the class of the real jurists.
This is when you were a teenager in Egypt.
Yeah, I think I was like 15 at the time. I was beaten quite savagely. And, you know, all the friendship of the past, you know, meant nothing overnight. And just watching bin Laden with his smugness and his arrogance put me back in that scary moment. But in my case, that beating, and there were several other after that, only sparked the defiance in me. I vowed and continue to vow never to shut up and to just stand up to this type of what I consider to be blasphemy against the Islamic tradition and what I consider to be a very beautiful and humanistic tradition.
There's a Jewish writer and journalist, Yossi Klein Halevi, who's written a book about a journey of worshiping with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. And he wrote Islam had a genius for fearlessness. The dark side was the suicide bombers, but he also saw a great strength. And I mean, that's also a quality that I hear coming through in your voice and in your story. I mean, what is the theological root of this fearlessness in Islam?
Well, you're sort of going to laugh. It's actually it goes back to the theology of jihad. I mean, jihad means to struggle, right? I mean, it doesn't mean a holy war. It means to struggle and to stand for what you believe and to stand with strength and to trust that your reward at the end for doing what you do is with God. And what I am doing, I believe, is jihad. What by writing my books and by lecturing and by speaking out, I believe is jihad. And I believe that if someone decides to kill me because of this, I believe I die as a martyr.
Khaled Abou El Fadl is the Omar and Esmeralda Alfi Distinguished Fellow in Islamic Law at UCLA. His books are banned in several countries, but they are found in bootleg copies across the Muslim world. This is Speaking of Faith. After a short break, we'll explore Protestant fundamentalism and Jewish extremism through the stories of Christian philosopher Richard Mao and Jerusalem-based journalist Yossi Klein Halevi. I'm Krista Tippett. Stay with us.
Audio cassettes and transcripts are available by calling 1-800-777-TEXT or by visiting our website at speakingoffaith.org. Speaking of Faith is a production of Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Welcome back to Speaking of Faith, conversation about belief, meaning, issues, and ideas. Today, the power of fundamentalism.
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if in fact God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
These were the controversial remarks made on national television 2 days after the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks by the Reverend Jerry Falwell, pastor of a 22,000-member fundamentalist Baptist church and one of America's most outspoken conservative Christians.
I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
He later apologized, but for some, like Richard Mao, Falwell's remarks exposed the worst of modern Christian fundamentalism. Richard Mao is the president of Fuller Theological Seminary, one of the world's leading centers of evangelical scholarship. And he grew up in a fundamentalist home.
My dad had had a profound religious conversion one night when he was asked to perform. He was a hillbilly band musician, and he preached on street corners, and he spoke in rescue missions, and he became a minister in a Dutch Reformed denomination. But he never really lost that initial fundamentalist way of viewing things. And by that, I mean, he always had a kind of hostility toward anything that was associated with Protestant liberalism. We were raised in a context where we were kind of anti-Catholic. We tended to think of the Pope, if not as the Antichrist, as a good friend of the Antichrist.
Richard Mao traces the origins of modern fundamentalism to the turn of the 20th century, when liberal Protestant theologians began to embrace critical methods of studying the Bible. Most disturbing for some of the faithful, like his father, was a tendency to dismiss the supernatural power of God. And so they began to stress the importance of the fundamentals.
The fundamentals were generally acknowledged to be a list of this sort, that it's people who believe that the Bible is the authoritative word of God. It's a high view of Scripture. And so it's the presupposition that you bring to the Bible as authoritative word from God. You believe that Jesus wasn't just a great human teacher, but that he was God incarnate, the Son of God, that he was born of a virgin, that his death on the cross was a substitutionary atoning death. You know, that what happened on the cross somehow brought about, in some mysterious way, it brought about our salvation in a way that nothing else could have done. And it's the belief that he's going to come again, that the world has not seen the last of Jesus. Fundamentalists also have an intense interest in Bible prophecy. I mean, the word literal and literalists are really misapplied to fundamentalists because they play around a lot with the symbols of the Scriptures, you know, the beast,
right,
of the book of Revelation. And they'll ask the question, who does that stand for? And so they see that as a revelation in a kind of coded form that imparts genuine information about things that are going on in our own world.
So talk to me about the experiences, you know, the most vivid memories you have of growing up in that kind of context.
Well, for one thing, there was a vast network of institutions and organizations. There was, of course, the local church, but we had summer Bible conferences. We had youth organizations like Youth for Christ and Young Life and later on, you know, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and Campus Crusade. We had evangelistic crusades of the sort that, you know, Billy Graham made very famous, but there were a lot of evangelists that came through town. So it was being a fundamentalist was a very busy thing. you got to do a lot of things.
Why? Well, I mean, is there a theological underpinning of that?
Well, because fundamentalists were very concerned about conversion, and they were very open to creating organizations that reached out to different groups of people who needed to be converted. And so they placed a big emphasis on evangelizing young people. And you get these marvelously complex networks of organizations. And they had radio programs. The seminary that I head up was started by Charles E. Fuller, radio evangelist in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, who pioneered in religious broadcasting, one of the first international radio broadcasts. And every week he did his radio program, and his wife was there, and she read the letters from people. And to this day, I get people who come up to me and say, I can still remember Mrs. Fuller reading the letters on the radio. And they had these gospel songs. They had wonderful choirs and quartets. In many ways, the fundamentalists who were very much against some of the more visible manifestations of popular culture. You've got to remember, these are people who did not go to the movies. They did not dance. They did not drink, smoke. They didn't play pool. They didn't play cards. They had all of this list of negatives, and they're very well known for things that they cannot do. And there you can find a lot of common ground with Hasidic Judaism and the more fundamentalist kind of Islam. But because they didn't go to the movies or they didn't go to dances on Saturday night, they created their own rather vital forms of, as it were, religious entertainment.
And now Mrs. Fuller's going to read to you from some of the letters, if I can find her here in the studio. Where are you, honey? Here, come on. Right here? All right, come on.
Well, good evening, friends. Here is a good letter from San Francisco. Dear Mr. Fuller, I was talking to a young man who told me he found the Lord through hearing your message over the radio. While staying home to take care of his brothers and sisters, he would turn on the radio, and now he's saved and is a lieutenant in the Salvation Army and letting his light shine that others may see his good works and glorify our Father which is in heaven.
Richard Mao began to question his fundamentalist upbringing when he became caught up in the political movements of the 1960s. He became a passionate advocate for civil rights, an opponent of the Vietnam War, and an organizer in the radical left-wing SDS while a graduate student. Yet in recent years, he's done a great deal of thinking and writing about what the fundamentalist impulse reveals of human nature and what it has added to American culture. And with some irony, he traces those insights directly back to his a-religious political activism of the 1960s.
It was a fascinating experience because I was firmly committed to the anti-war cause and also the civil rights movement, just to take, you know, two prominent movements of the 60s. And yet, one of the things that struck me sitting in those endless participatory democracy, anti-war protest discussion groups was that the passion of many of the young radicals was not unlike the passion of fundamentalism. And in my experience, as I left fundamentalism, and I left it behind for the three reasons that I talk about a lot in my book. It was very anti-intellectual, and I could not live with that as I began to study and became interested in the intellectual quest, the scholarly life. It was very otherworldly. Fundamentalists were not very interested in doing anything about issues of social justice or peace or righteousness in the larger world. And the other was a kind of separatistic spirit, a willingness to refuse to cooperate with any other Christians, even if you disagreed with them, even on some minor point of doctrine. But, you know, it's very interesting. In the civil rights movement, hymns were very important to the spirit of that movement.
We shall overcome.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And for me, in many of those situations, as I was struggling, for example, as a person in my 20s with whether or not I was going to answer the draft call and be enlisted in the armed forces and possibly go to Vietnam. And I believed, and I still believe, that it was an unjust war. And I could not go, even though I wasn't a pacifist. And it looked like maybe I was going to have to go to jail. And people in my family and in my larger fundamentalist evangelical network were very critical of me. And it was a very lonely time for me spiritually and religiously because I felt cut off from my roots. But what was interesting was that in all of that civil rights and anti-war stuff, the things that sustained me were those hymns.
Even when you did not perceive yourself to be nearly as religious.
Yeah, in those revival meetings, those hymns actually had a very radical scope and a radical tone to them. You know, I surrender all. Mm-hmm. And is your all on the altar of sacrifice laid? And yet, it was a very narrow radicalism. They concentrated on, you know, your sex life and maybe how you spent your money. But what struck me and many of my friends in the 1960s was it was also an important question. Are you willing to yield your racism to the Lordship of Jesus Christ? You know, are you willing to be obedient to the gospel even when it goes against what your government asks you to do? Those were very important questions. And it was really the radicalism of those hymns that went well beyond anything that I think the people who sang them, who taught them to me, anything that they intended. But I took the words, I saw myself as taking the words more seriously in some cases than they did.
You named the passion and the exhilaration of the civil rights movement and those political movements that you became involved in, and And I also think when I read your work that there's a real emotionalism to, you know, to a gospel tent meeting that you describe. Is that for you also a defining characteristic of fundamentalism?
Yeah, I have to say, and I was with a group of sort of ex-fundamentalist types recently, and I think I made them a little nervous by saying this, but I said, you know, since those fundamentalist days, I've explored a lot of different strands of Christian spirituality, Benedictine and Franciscan and the Desert Fathers and the Desert Mothers and all these wonderful things, and I've learned so much. But in those moments, in those old revival meetings, when the preacher would say, every head bowed and every eye closed, and look into your heart, and do you really love Jesus? For me, those were some of the most sacred moments of my life. I don't think I ever since then have experienced the transcendence that I experienced. And I still have a deep appreciation and a kind of nostalgic. I have a nostalgia for that.
You know, we've talked in these months with regard to Islam, but also in a general way about the root sources of fundamentalism. And I think a positive question in there is, What draws people? What is the human appeal of fundamentalist religious experience? And I wonder if you could say something about that from a Christian perspective.
You know, in our so-called postmodern culture, there's a lot of confusion about questions of truth and value, morality, meaning. But there are a lot of folks, and I'm convinced this is at the heart of a lot of it. A lot of folks who just care about how their kids are going to grow up. As I go out into the churches, for example, the more conservative, fundamentalist-type churches, I meet so many parents who have gotten into that just because they wanted someplace they could bring their kids where they would get something about a life that has meaning, that has solid values, that promises good things about the future. And fundamentalism, I want to say at its best, fundamentalism gives people some things to rely on, some solid foundations. I don't think we ought to dismiss that as a silly thing or some kind of inferior impulses. And for many people, and my own life is an example of this, it was a good place to begin. It just wasn't a good place to end up. But I'll always be grateful for people who, in my earliest days, told me that that Jesus loved me, that there's a God who's in charge of history, that there's a book that we can turn to find answers to some of the most basic issues of life. And I've nuanced that. It's gotten a lot more complex for me. But the fundamental way of viewing it is still what I hang on to for dear life.
Richard Mao is president of Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith on the Power of Fundamentalism.
I grew up in a Holocaust survivor family in Brooklyn in the early 60s.
Yossi Klein Halevi is a former Jewish extremist who lives in Jerusalem.
The Holocaust was the background and the foreground of our family life, which was very warm and loving, but was also in some way an act of defiance against Hitler. We survived. My father was a survivor from Hungary who survived the war by living in a hole in the forest. That event, I would say, that hole was the prism through which I was raised to see the world. The notion of the Jews as a besieged, pursued, hated people, a people that could never find its place with the rest of humanity.
In his teens, Yossi Klein Halevi became passionately involved in militant, quasi-terrorist activities of the Jewish Defense League, and he was a leader in a movement called the Student Struggle for Soviet Jewry. In his late 20s, in 1982, Yossi Klein Halevi moved to Israel, which he describes as his spiritual home. Now in his 40s, he is Israeli correspondent for the New Republic and a commentator on Israeli affairs for the Los Angeles Times. He is a committed Zionist, an observant Jew, and at the same time, a spiritual seeker and a politically moderate Israeli. He spoke with me from his home in Jerusalem about what his life has taught him of religious fundamentalism's power.
To be a fundamentalist means to be wholly immersed, not wholly, H-O-L-Y, but quite the opposite, wholly, sure. To be wholly immersed in your own theology, your own suffering, your own drama, your own historical and theological drama, to the absolute exclusion of any other drama. But the truth is, when I look back on it, it really allowed me to turn what otherwise could have been an emotionally crippling experience into a very vigorous youth. You are part of the chosen people. You're part of a spiritual elite. You are it.
Right.
And there is nothing more exhilarating than being it.
The word intensity, yes, recurs a great deal in your memoir. And that word, I think, has a particular appeal for young people.
You know, not long ago, I went up to Nazareth in the Galilee, where a group of Muslim fundamentalists are camping out, trying to build a mosque that will overshadow the Basilica of the Annunciation. And really a typical fundamentalist move of trying to overshadow another faith by even just physically building a bigger religious structure.
And were they Palestinian?
Yes, they were, mm-hmm, Palestinian. And I went up there and I spent some time with these young people. And I was struck by their pleasantness, and it really brought me back to my teenage years, the self-confidence, the disdain, and among themselves, the private jokes. Being in a fundamentalist world, it's so funny. I mean, that'll sound ludicrous to outsiders, but when you are with your friends, out away from the cameras, there is nothing funnier than sitting around with a group of fundamentalist insiders and laughing at the rest of the world. And so much of the fundamentalist's humor is mocking all the jerks outside, and everyone outside your circle is a jerk. Everyone.
Talk about that. Talk about how your perception of the humanity of those you are fighting, or perhaps you feel you're defending yourself, but your opponents.
Right.
How your understanding of that is changed, distorted by fundamentalist thinking. Are they human beings?
Look, right now, I'm talking to you from a battle zone. I'm in Jerusalem. We hear ambulances regularly on the road just below where I live. I live at the very edge of Jerusalem, literally the last row of houses before the Judean desert and the West Bank begins. So I'm sitting physically on the border, the precise point of the border. I feel the war impinging constantly, so that my relationship with Muslim fundamentalism is not neutral. It's not. It's very hard for me to feel that empathy, which in better times I am able to draw on. But right now, I feel that my children are on the front lines every time they step outside the door, every time they go on a bus. My daughter, my 16-year-old daughter, was telling me the other day that the first thing she does, she gets on a bus, she immediately sits in the back because she knows that suicide bombers tend to blow themselves up in the center of the bus to kill more people. And then she scans all the passengers to see who the likely candidates are, whether there's anyone on the bus who might be a suicide bomber. And then when she looks around and she sees everyone looks okay, then she'll put on her headphones and listen to her music.
Tell me what you understand. Explain to me what's going on in the mind of someone who thinks it's righteous and virtuous to sit in the middle of a bus with a bomb.
For the suicide bomber, the victims are abstract. They're not even real people. They're props in an apocalyptic drama in which he is the star. And all of history, all of humanity has been set up for his passion and for his justification, for him to reclaim what he believes is rightfully his, to right the wrongs that have been done to him, to his people, to his religion, so that this is an event that is not just sanctioned by God, but has been set up by God as the culminating moment of human experience, the culminating moment of the purpose of God's creation, which is to right the wrongs, the cosmic wrongs that have been done. It's to banish evil. And that is what's going through the mind of the fundamentalist terrorist. And that emotion I know very well, because although I personally was not involved directly in terrorist acts as a teenager, some of my closest friends were people who were planting bombs at Soviet embassies to try to pressure the Soviet Union at that time to free the Jews, to allow Jewish immigration. And I was intimately involved with those people and tangentially involved with that terrorist world. And the fantasies that I had of destroying the enemies of the Jews, they were moments almost of, not almost, they were moments of religious ecstasy.
So I wonder if something that distinguishes, let's say, positive religious moment from this kind of destructive religious moment is, in fact, the focus of the motivation.
Right.
Something that became clear to me also in reading your work is this this tightrope that a religious fundamentalist walks, that in focusing on evil, there is the danger of becoming evil oneself. In living with a consciousness of enemies, one becomes an enemy.
That's a really good point that you're making. And that is that when you put darkness, evil, injustice as the center point of your cosmology, then you risk being co-opted, drawn into that darkness. And I think that that was one of the moments for me of revelation of how my obsession with Jewish suffering, with the Holocaust, was distorting my life and my spiritual life.
After his turn from fundamentalism, Yossi Klein Halevi was deeply influenced by research on people who suffered catastrophic traumas like the Holocaust or the Soviet gulags. They survived and created meaningful lives afterward by reaching out to others and drawing on their own deepest spiritual foundations. Eventually, he became profoundly curious about the other religions with which he shares life in Israel. In June 2001, he published At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. Yossi Klein Halevi proposes that only when Jews and Palestinians understand themselves not as victims, but as survivors, can fundamentalism be diffused. Still, I asked him how the survivor approaches the world so differently from the victim.
I think the survivor understands that this is, in its very nature, a horrible world, a world of unbearable suffering, a world that, I would say, a world where the soul really doesn't belong. And what the survivor tries to learn from his or her experience is generosity rather than rage. Fundamentalists crave easy answers. The survivor understands that there are no easy answers in this world. And the more you get closer to how God must see this world, the more you're able to take on paradoxes, contradictions. And that forces you into a mode of constant empathy, where you force yourself to constantly look at how the world appears to others. And again, you know, in better moments, sitting here in Israel, in better moments, I've been able to at least try to develop that sense of empathy toward the Palestinians, toward the Islamic world. It's much easier when you don't feel under constant attack.
Right. And what I'm so aware of in this journey that you describe with other faiths also is that you recovered precisely the thing that gets lost in the fundamentalist experience, which is the humanity. You know, you wrote about one Muslim Sufi sheikh, suddenly the menacing mass had a benign face.
Right. Right. I think that the journey that I took into these two faiths was a conscious refutation of who I once was. The fundamentalist is ready, in theory at least, to give his or her life for their faith. And I felt that my transition from fundamentalist to pluralist wouldn't be complete until I'd managed to draw on that fundamentalist vitality and in some way transmute it. And I decided I needed to not just engage Muslims and Christians in dialogue.
Right, that's where we always go, isn't it? We go to dialogue.
No. I felt, and here, this is what I learned. This is what I learned from the fundamentalists. It's not enough to talk. You have to live it. You have to fully immerse. You have to live your belief to its ultimate moment and enter all of your fears. And believe me, there were moments when I was terrified, sitting in a mosque in a Gaza refugee camp, wearing a Jewish skull cap. And you really wonder, are you going to get out of the camp alive? What I learned in that very small and limited experiment was that when one approaches another faith with reverence and love, the resistance and all of the political and theological and psychological barriers that keep us apart, especially in this land, somehow get bypassed. And you're able to get through in a way that is impossible when the discourse is confined to discourse.
Mm-hmm. And to political solutions, I suppose, and
that's
political
right.
Vocabulary.
At this point, I don't believe there is a political solution to this conflict. I think there's so much accumulated rage and resentment and misunderstandings that I personally despair of a political breakthrough. I don't believe that we're anywhere near a spiritual breakthrough either. Although God doesn't need millions of people in order to effect change, where spiritual process differs perhaps from the political reality is that it doesn't require masses of people in the same way that political change does. In fact, if you look at the history of religion, any religion, it's the story of a few eccentrics, a few obsessives who take it upon themselves to make their lives examples of that vision, which doesn't yet exist, and allow themselves to become almost entry points through which the divine presence can interact with humanity and change humanity. So the way to resist fundamentalism is not through anger and hatred, because they'll win. You cannot out-hate a fundamentalist. The only way to win against fundamentalism is by drawing on those divine qualities that we as human beings are called upon by every faith at its best to emulate. And those are the qualities of an open heart, of empathy, and peace.
Journalist and author Yossi Klein Halevi. Earlier in this hour, you heard Fuller Seminary President Richard Mao and UCLA Law Professor Khaled Abou-el-Fadl. We'd love to hear your comments on this program. Please send us an email at mail@speakingoffaith.org. You can also contact us through our website at speakingoffaith.org. While you're there, you'll find book and music lists, and you can listen to this program again as well as our previous programs. You can also call Minnesota Public Radio at 1-800-228-7123. This program was produced by Brian Newhouse and Marge Ostrushko. Technical direction for this show came from Tom Mudge and Craig Thorson, with assistance from Michael DeMark, Alan Strickland, Scott Liebers, and Jennifer Lubke. Thanks also to producer Kate Moose, intern Sarah Dick, and technical director Mitch Hanley. Speaking of Faith's executive producer is Bill Buesenberg. And I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us again next week.
Speaking of Faith is supported by the Pew Charitable Trusts, investing in ideas, returning results. PewTrusts.com. Additional support is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, committed to serving their congregations, families, and communities through customer-focused financial strategies. Online at Thrivent.com. Audio cassettes and transcripts are available by calling 1-800-777-TEXT or by visiting our website at speakingoffaith.org. This program is a production of Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.